This past Wednesday night, we looked at session 7 of Sandra Richter's Epic of Eden Isaiah study, and we didn't get to watch all of the video, but we ended up having ample discussion about the workbook review, so I want to cover some of that with you. But before I begin, just to rehearse again the reminder that we get of the Lord in the prophets, why it's so critical for us to turn to the prophets. Philip Yancey, in his book, The Bible Jesus Read, reminds us that in the section of the prophets, that's when we really get our first glimpse into the heart and personality of God, especially in terms of his heart and his passion for his people. You really don't, before the prophets, get God aching, seeing God broken for the loss of his people. So even though you and I might approach the prophetic books thinking they're all about judgment, they're all about future signs and prophetic dates, much more so they're about a revelation of the heart of God, and secondarily, not just about ensuring success or when will these events happen in the future, but I like what Dr. John Oswald said. The function of biblical prophecy is not about giving guidance or ensuring success. That's not the primary purpose. But rather, it's to call people into relationship, much like the prophet and God are in dynamic relationship. As Moses went up on the mountain and met with God Almighty, that's what we're finding through the prophets, what God desires, that kind of vibrancy, that kind of intimacy, as well as that kind of obedience. So unlike the pagan gods of Isaiah's day, these gods that simply want to use you, not have a relationship with you, we're seeing something very different in the God that Isaiah and the other prophets reveal. And the difference, one of the ways in which we see that difference is in this word hesed that we talked about 3 weeks ago. This word that means, well, I don't know what the word means, because it's not found in any other religion. It's really not found in any other language. There's no English word for it. It's a word they had to make up in the Hebrew language, but you find it 250 times in the Old Testament. And a third of those uses refer to God. This word that, again, it's hard to translate, but it means the undying devotion of a superior to an inferior, especially when it is undeserved. So in Isaiah 54:10, you see the word of God saying, though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed, yet my unfailing love, and the word there would be hesed or chesed, my unfailing love for you will not be shaken. This superior loving an inferior who does not deserve it. It's this beautiful revelation that we get of the heart of God, the compassion of God, even for a sinful people. So I hope that's been a blessing as we've gone through Isaiah to see God again, even though he will discipline, God will judge, this constant reaching, this constant brokenness of the Lord for his people is really found on every page. And we see the extent of that reach when we get into the servant songs, and that's where we are in session 7. There really are 4, some might argue 5, servant songs in Isaiah. And so in our workbooks, we work through Isaiah 42, 49, 50, and really, which is Sandra Richter, a very technical spiritual term, the kicker. The kicker is Isaiah 52 and 53 and what is said there. Some add Isaiah 61. But we see in there that this second servant, unlike the first servant who is Israel, who has fumbled and bumbled what they are to do, this second servant that is sent clearly sees, is no longer deaf and dumb as they were described in Isaiah 42, the first servant. Here, this second servant clearly sees God's will, brings about justice, is a light to the Gentiles. Isaiah 49, this servant hears clearly, rescues people, is the light to the Gentiles. Isaiah 50, this one obeys, finally. He knows God. He suffers. He is true light versus false light. And then Isaiah 52 through 53, we could stay here all day looking at Isaiah 53, verse 2. This one who had no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him. He had no appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised and we did not esteem him. And then just following on down to verse 5, he was pierced for our transgression, crushed for our iniquities. This second servant, and she keeps asking this question, just like in Mark at Caesarea Philippi, who do you say that I am? That there really is no consensus in Judaism now, present day. Who is this servant? Who can it be? it surely can't be, even though there's some parts of it you think maybe it's Moses, maybe it's Isaiah, maybe it's Jeremiah, because he was certainly crushed. He certainly went through it. Yet how do they continue? How is it there's resurrection for them? How is it? And so even in a presentation she did one time at a college, Dr. Richter was saying there was in front of her Christians and Hindus and Jews and atheists, and how do you come to consensus about who is this second servant in Isaiah? And there's who is both divine, apparently, because he can suffer for sins, but he's also human. And so the answer for that we know is that can only be met in the Son of God, love who and God who has become incarnate, the second person of the Trinity. So that first servant, as you go into day one in the workbook, that first servant is like some of the Disney movies or classic movies where you think that the good guy is a good guy and eventually find out halfway through the film the person you thought was a good guy all along is actually the villain. And that's what happens here. The first servant does not keep what they ought to do, does not keep what they ought to be. So who is, the question then, this second servant? And then in day one, on page 124, we are reminded again that image is a big deal. And our culture makes image a huge deal. But in terms of the Imago Dei, the image of God, that we are all created, Genesis 1 and 2, we were made in God's image. Image is everything. It really defines so many things and gives worth and value to us. But there is a worry that God is very clear. You don't make an image of him. Because the images that are made, no wonder Israel is called, Jacob and Israel are called deaf and dumb in Isaiah 42, because they've become what they've worshipped. They've created images for themselves of pagan gods, and now they've become just like those images. They're deaf, dumb, and blind. And she gives us a great reminder on page 124 of the workbook that we will slowly and steadily be transformed into whatever image we worship. I mean, you can see that in our culture today. We become what we worship. And again, there is to be no image of God, but we're made in his image. And if we worship another being, if we worship another god, another idol, we end up looking very much like them. In day two, she talks again about that. She contrasts the first and second servant. And then in day three, she talks about three different New Testament scriptures, Matthew 8, Matthew 12, and John 12, where Isaiah is quoted, the healing at Peter's house, the healing at the synagogue, but then also the beginning of the Book of Glory at Bethany, where they've seen Lazarus raised from the dead, and yet they're still blinded, and their hearts are still hardened, even after that kind of testimony, because they just can't get their heads around. And listen, I understand it then, but I especially understand in Isaiah's day, how do you get your head around God incarnate before it happens? How do you get your head around the second servant being Jesus when you haven't seen the cross and experienced the resurrection? You and I are on the other side of the cross and resurrection and really have a deeper accountability for that. But I can understand their struggle. And again, in Jesus's day, well, they should have known it was Jesus, right? But he comes healing on Sabbath day, and that was such a big deal for them. You can understand why they struggled. He hung out with sinners. You can understand why we struggle. We live on the other side of the cross and resurrection. It shouldn't be difficult for us, but I can understand and see why it might have been a struggle for them. But there's no other way to get to that second and suffering servant in Isaiah 52 and 53 and elsewhere, without coming to the conclusion that that must be Jesus the Christ. In day four, she talks about Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 6 and 12, and talks again about the contrast with the other gods. The other gods are territorial. The other gods are gods of fertility and rain, so you can see the pull and how they were tempted in their day. But also, listen, not just they were tempted to syncretize their faith or to blend their faith. Let's be honest, in our culture, we were tempted to blend our faith and not to be clear about our faith. And to, even she says on day four, aren't we the Christian in the aren't we tempted to say, you know what, Christianity and Islam, it's kind of the same thing. We kind of worship the same God. Now, again, you can say that Islam has come out of the Jewish faith and Christian faith, that they've taken those scriptures saying that that's the God of their faith. But is it hard for us to say to folks who are struggling, hey, we are a different faith, that the God that we serve is not the God of that you serve? And she concludes on page 134, the New Testament is not ambiguous. There is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven that has been given among men by which he must be saved, quoting Acts 4:12. Why do you think that God's people are perennially challenged by the desire to blend the identity of God of the Bible with other deities? Why do we wind up affirming such things as Christians and Muslims worship the same God? There are some, we talked about it in a discussion last night, there's some clear, sharp contrast between the God of Islam, who could care less about you, who is not a personal God, versus a Judeo-Christian God. Yes, they're both monotheists, so the only three monotheistic religions in the world, but what the Old Testament and New Testament say about God is radically different than what the Quran says. This is how God operates, and this is who God is. Very different, and yet in our day, where we want to be very compassionate, we want to be inclusive, even though by definition you're not being inclusive when you do that. I understand that there's a struggle for believers. And part of that comes back to day five. She talks about the Rudy movie, which I appreciate. But she ends up going on to say, from the garden until today, we struggle with moving the center of the universe to us. That really, and she talks about how the Phoenicians have done that and how that spells out horrifically in their lives, where we make God conform to our image. But really, we've been doing that for several hundred years now in Western culture, where really at the beginning of the Enlightenment period with Descartes, when he says, I think, therefore I am, it's interesting he uses the words I am there, God's very own name, when he reveals that to Moses. But we really shifted the world from God-centered to man-centered, from God is absolute and makes clear revelation to know we determine and define who God is, and we will put him in the boxes we prefer. We'll shape him in the way we like to shape him. And really, not only from Descartes, Rene Descartes, up to Immanuel Kant, whose first name actually means God with us, but really in his philosophical struggles is saying, you know what, you can't know that God is near, that there's this Kantian wall, this ceiling where we can't know for certain God in how he is, so we do our best to kind of make that up. There are no absolute truths because we can't know absolutely everything about God or his revelation. So we're kind of left to make him up, and we're left to make him up. Let's be honest. All of us struggle. All of us are sinners, and so we end up making God in our own image when there is not a clear and absolute revelation from God, so much so that we've not only turned our own Western civilization upside down with the Enlightenment, where we kind of pick and choose what we like, but it's interesting. I heard a speech given or a debate at Millsaps College years ago where they had a Muslim come on campus and say that the Enlightenment has caused the recent terrorist activity. You say, well, how is that possible? Well, it's because in the past, when there was a belief in absolute truth, when there was a belief in institutions, it was only a cleric, a Muslim cleric, that could issue a fatwa, that could issue a statement saying this is what we are to do and not to do, and issue, hey, this should be a time for holy war. Well, listen, when you turn the world upside down and says, you know, it's really up to you, that everything's relative and you can decide for yourself, well, all of a sudden you have someone who's not a cleric, Osama bin Laden, he's issuing fatwas. Why? Because truth is relative, because I can determine my own reality. And so Western civil culture has exported, in some ways, death unto itself. Because we've said to anybody, remake God in your own image. You can box him in however you want to. And you see, if you read Dr. Richter's writings, how that plays out in the Phoenician culture with child sacrifice, where they kill their very own children, sacrifice their very own children, too. We're seeing the sacrifice and the killing and the slaughtering of others in terrorist name, because anybody can issue a fatwa. There's real no true authority or absolute truth. So much here in Isaiah. Again, it says so much about who God is, but it also says to the God's people, this is his prophetic word. It has to be responded to, and it has to be absolute truth to you, receiving the horrific consequences then and today when we don't respond well to that word. We're going to finish up next week in session 8. I hope you'll, if you can't be present with us next Wednesday night or this coming Wednesday night, I hope you'll listen as we conclude the series.